My name is Neil Pickering. I'm the head of business development for BV North Sea Operations, and I'm delighted to have been asked to chair this session. But the main things is that I wanted to introduce the event and the panelists and thank them and the two sponsors. So first and foremost, I would like to thank the main sponsor, who is Maritime Development Limited, an Aberdeen-based company who provides tailored consultancy equipment and personnel packages to the energy sector. And our silver sponsor, which is Petrasco Energy Logistics, who are a global leader in freight forwarding. So today, we're going to explore and four subjects in particular on rigging and lifting. They include the development of rigging and lifting regulations and standards, the challenges of moving forward through the energy transition, how to maintain competence levels in the sector, and how technology will change sector in the sector, and how will we see the advent of autonomous lifting and cranes, etc. So I'm delighted to be joined by four experts in the field, who are Brian Beattie, who's the Lifting and Technical Authority Aberdeen Operator CNOOC. We have Lorenz Nehring, Business Development Manager at Ampleman, who are the global leaders in walk-to-work solutions. Hugh Ramsey, who's the Group Sales Manager at Sales Lift Offshore. And finally, Ben Dobbs, who's the Head of Technical Services at LEEA, Lifting Equipment Engineers Association. So just before we move on, so the structure of today's event will be a panel session, as you see in front of you now. We'll run from now until about around about 3:15, including questions and answers, and then there will be a networking session afterwards, which will run to about 4:30. So please press the networking icon on the left of your screen at the point that point, and the platform will randomly pair you up with fellow professionals within the sector. And finally, please feel free to drop some questions in the chat at the right-hand side of the screen at any point during the session, and then when we get to the end, we'll pick up the questions that have been posted, and we'll put them back to the panel for a... Okay, so we'll kick off. So I've already mentioned the names of the guys that are on the panel, but I would like to get them to introduce themselves personally and give a little bit of background on them. So if we could kick off with yourself, Brian, if you could go first.
Yeah, good afternoon. Yeah, my name is Brian Beattie. I'm CNOOC's Marine and Lifting Technical Authority. So background, I was trained as a BSN 121 appointed person. I work for a well intervention company as a technical manager. We operated active and passive compensated derricks and towers. I sat on the IMCA Crane and Winch Operations Work Group for a number of years, and also on the Y-Rope Discard Subcommittee. I joined CNOOC following an incident. So in theory, I was employed as a marine authority, but in reality, they were looking more for a lifting authority because they'd had quite a serious incident. In terms of what we're going to discuss today, my interests are, or my knowledge is based around the compensation systems, and in particular, we had a line failure due to what somebody calls cyclical bending fatigue. I've had quite a few dealings with remote access on cranes. And in terms of CNOOC, we had, from the incident, we recognized a number of compliance issues, and we did something about training with regards to that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Brian. Hugh, if you could go
Yep,
next.
thank you, Neil. Yeah, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Hugh Ramsey. I'm the Group Sales Manager for Safe Lift Offshore, locally based design, engineering, and manufacturing company looking after material handling equipment. In my career working for different manufacturers and different distributors, that's been around lifting, mooring, and towing applications. That's given me an insight into a wide range of products, applications, and the rules, guidelines, best practice, and standards around those. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Hugh. Lorenz, if you could go next, please.
Yeah, thanks, Neil. Lawrence Nearing, I'm the Business Development Manager for Ampleman in the Aberdeen office down at Waterloo Quay. I'm predominantly trying to develop the business of walk-to-work solutions through the motion-compensated gangways that we have. We've recently introduced a 5-ton lifting capability on a motion compensation system. And I'm very interested to offer, I guess, the application of the technology and the uses that we see globally, and in particular in the wind industry, and also gain some advice and gain some knowledge from the other experts and all those asking questions around how we can work further in the future, given the Brexit situation and given the challenging oil price we have at the moment.
Okay, thanks, Lawrence. And finally, Ben, if you could give us a little
bit. Hi, I'm Benjamin Dobbs. I'm the head of technical services for LEA, which is the Lifting Equipment Engineers Association. We're a global trade association with 1,300 members approximately worldwide. Mostly those are involved with the inspection, maintenance, and thorough examination of lifting equipment, although we do have some end users. We're in pretty much every industry that involves lifting equipment, including offshore, oil and gas. My responsibilities for LEA are to look after LEA's technical interests and their interpretation of standards and legislation. And I represent our membership on numerous standards steering groups such as BSI, CEN and ISO. Thank you.
Thanks for that. Okay, guys, thanks for that background summary there. So, okay, we'll kick off then with the first of the four topics that we want to discuss, which is the development of rigging and lifting regulations as a standard. So, as we all know, LOLA regulations came into operation in 1998 and have been prevalent ever since. The purpose of which was to reduce risk and injury from lifting equipment. So that's where we've come from. We are today still using those same regulations. And I guess a question to the panel is, do we think what we have in place today in and around lifting operations, lifting equipment, is adequate given today's environment? And I guess, Brian, I'll go to you first from an operator perspective.
Okay, so from an operator, you know, we see things a little bit different to, say, you know, other parts of the industry. We have typically quite a narrow focus on this, and that's because we don't have a lot of expertise. So what we tend to do is we tend to look towards other bodies to provide us that level of expertise and support, and that's why, you know, it's not unusual to find operators tying themselves very much to a PTO, right? And that has some great benefits. You know, we're obviously tapping into quite a, you know, huge knowledge base there, but it also has some disadvantages as well. And if I can touch on some of those first, right? And the main one that we see, or I saw when I came into CNOOC, remembering that was on the back of what had been quite a serious incident, right? We saw a disconnect between people who had followed the APITO route, right, and people who were involved in lifting activities but were unable to follow the APITO route. And what I mean by that is that for those who are not familiar with the progression through APITO, is that you do this initial basic training, then you're expected to go to the working environment and under supervision perform a series of lifting activities. Right. Now, APITO states that those number of activities is quite large. Okay. So it's quite a significant number of lifts these guys have got to perform. Right. And some of them are quite complex as well. Now, there was a portion of the workforce, right, who were involved in lifting activities, typically maintenance technicians and the like, right, who were never getting exposed to the types of lifting activities or the number of lifting activities they needed to go on to become a PTO stage, the stage three level. So the stage three level, so you've done your basic training, you've gone into the workplace, which is the stage two, you've done these lifts, and then you go back and then you get an assessment. So up until the stage three, you're not assessed to be competent as a rigger or as a banks and slinger, right? And that causes an issue. Okay. And that means that these guys must remain under supervision at all times, which has got a justification, but it does cause manpower issues. And it tends to cause like a gray area as well about what guys can and can't do with a stage one. And that took a lot of effort and a lot of argument to get, make people understand that if you haven't been assessed as competent, you're not competent, right? So you cannot perform these lifts on, without supervision. And that then led myself, and I can only speak for the company I work for and the approach that we've taken, that's kind of led us towards looking at ECITB, right? And in particular, one particular course, which was moving engineering construction loads under supervision. Okay. And the reason for that is because it had less complex lifts than what the OPITU demanded, right? But it also allowed us to do a bit of variation, right? Not under the ECITB banner, but just allowed us to manipulate, if you like, the expectations of that to something that was more fit for purpose. And that was something that we ended up calling light load lifting. Right. Okay. So there are other avenues other than a P2 and the route that we took, which is a tailor-made. There is companies, and I'm just cognizant of bringing up too many names, but there are some companies which have developed their own program under, say, an SQA banner, right? Right. And they're really important. And they're really important, or I see the importance, when you start to move away from Europe. Okay. So there's a huge demand for standards of training in areas, you know, for example, in the Middle East, things of this. And I've been in meetings with chaps from those areas who are crying out for a standard. But when they get offered up a PITO, they say that we cannot do that because it doesn't fit to what we do. And that's why there are some companies now coming up with much more flexible training programs, where it's almost like a modular approach where you build your own competence demand suitable for your own industry or your own company, right? Which seems to me to better fit the approach moving forward. Okay.
Okay. No, thanks for that, Brian. Yeah. I mean, there's always a requirement to try and standardize as much as possible. And, you know, you get standards that are specified particularly for the offshore industry and others that aren't. And there's always debate as to which ones are most adequate. But just moving on from that then, in terms of the impact that the regulations that we currently work around have in terms of reducing risk and incident rates. I mean, I was doing a little bit of research. So HSE statistics, but they're only published up to 2019. We're still under the headings of handling, lifting and carrying and struck by moving objects, but it could be something. So we're still getting 2019 just less than, you know, 30 incidents of people being injured, and in 2017, which seems to have been the best year, maybe there wasn't a lot going on offshore then, around about 18, 19. So just to the panel, so I'll go to you, Lawrence. So do you think that the current regulatory regime is having a positive or is having the required impact on reducing risk and incident occurrences?
I think what I'd like to sort of just talk a little bit about is what Brian was mentioning. I think from our perspective, we are very much restricted to training the various levels of a PITO, or according to PITO, on a vessel. And that vessel has to have a certain operating environment for you to be able to get through those levels. So it wasn't necessarily just the number of lifts. We also have sea states involved. We also have, POB constraints, where you have to have an assessor on board to have these operators trained through those levels. So not only are we restricted with regards to the number of cranes we have offshore or number of crane gangways we have offshore, we're also restricted to the number of jobs that we get with those, the number of assessors that we have with them. So I think we are also, as a service company, looking at different regulatory bodies to see how we can train our crane operators. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. An ongoing process at the moment.
Yeah. Okay. So it's always so just maintaining the direction of travel in regulations. And so the Brexit effect, we're here, we've done it, we've moved on. Like it or hate it, depending which camp you sit in. I'll go to you, Ben. What's your view in terms of certification standards as a result of Brexit, and what impact's that going to have in this in the lifting and rigging arena?
Well, as I understand the current situation, the UK and the EU legislation to which the UN harmonised standards offer a presumption of conformity to remains the same in terms of the fundamental essential health and safety requirements. I also believe from many discussions on CERN and BSI committees that there is no desire for the UK to start a programme of creating new British standards, and it's likely that we will continue to opt the EN and where the exist ISO standards. This is also reciprocated from EU member states, as diverging would only have the effect of putting up more barriers to trade that neither side would benefit from. So I believe that for the time being, at least the coming year, BSI will and can remain a member of CERN and CERN-ELEC, which means the UK can contribute to the development of these standards. And I believe that there will be a review of this at some point in the future, but you know, you'd have to check that information further with BSI, who have a wealth of information on their website. But the fundamental major impact that we're going to see is really for the transfer of new products or the placing of new products onto the market, whereby we now see in this transition to the UKCA, the UK Conformity Assessment, which for self-certified goods will come into force from the 1st of January 2022, though people are being advised to get ready as soon as possible, because changes may come into effect sooner than that. And what this really means is that if you're placing goods on the market, whether any rigging equipment, any cranes onto the UK market or onto the European market from the UK, means that there is a fundamental barrier to trade in that you have to have this separate conformity assessment, and it will require that you need an authorised representative or a legal entity in the country that you're placing the product on the market to, in order to act on some of your legal obligations. As a minimum, that would be compiling the technical file, should the authorities wish to see it. In terms of user codes and user standards, then they tend to be national anyway and follow national legislation, which is all based primarily on the Use of Work Equipment Directive. And again, there's no real fundamental change within the legislation there, and things will continue as they are at this stage. But it's something perhaps to look towards the future as to where we go with this. The Machinery Directive, for example, is under review, and there may be changes which will enforce, which will cause other changes on a national level as well. But for the time being, I think we've got quite a long transition period for a further year before self-certified goods need to fall in line. And then thereafter, products don't really need to be marked. It can be marked on the documentation. So we'll be working on it over the course of the next year or so, and hopefully there'll be some resolution that'll ease the process.
Okay, well, thanks for that, Ben.
Thank you.
I'll move on to Hugh. In terms of the same question, so Brexit impact in lifting and rigging operations and equipment.
Yeah, well, it's a very significant topic for ourselves and our peers who design and manufacture goods that we then want to place both in the domestic market and into the European marketplace. So the guidance that Ben's given us this afternoon is very helpful in that respect. And of course, there's a process now of aligning ourselves with the new requirements in terms of paperwork and marking. So that's something that companies like ourselves definitely need clarity on, and organisations like LEA, of course, can help us in that respect. And of course, what we don't want is to end up in a position where we are disadvantaged in terms of competitively placing products into a certain market. That's one of the things that Brexit's created, is those types of issues or those types of concerns. And I guess, you know, we'll just have to work through those during the transition periods until we get to a point where there's a firm understanding of how we should proceed going forward.
Okay, now thanks for that, Hugh. Brian, I guess from an operator perspective then, in terms of the Brexit impact, how is there anything in particular that CNOOC have put in place to try and avoid or avert some of the potential complications caused by Brexit?
So we have frequent discussions about the impact from Brexit leading up to Brexit. I think if it can be specific from the training, there's no impact really to what we currently do. Okay, so I can absolutely see it from equipment point of view, but again, we look to other parts of industry to provide that level of competence. So we would go to, for example, to Hugh or to Lorenz and to ask them to provide us goods which are suitable and able to be used in the UK sector. And then that would be a, if you like, a black box for us. We'd expect them to be able to supply that.
Okay, thanks for that, Brian. So I guess, yeah, so just, you know, as Brexit is a transition that we're all going through, so I'll move on to the second topic, I guess, which is another transition, which is the energy transition. So, it, you know, it's picking up pace. I don't think anybody will deny that. There's a lot of activity out there. There's a lot of repositioning. The government's issued its 10-point plan, backed up by legislation and regulation. There's mutings about carbon taxes and all sorts of stuff. So, and that, I guess, could potentially bring with it an increase in the reuse of offshore installations, increase in decommissioning. So the government, you know, you're going to have the convergence of sectors. So you've got renewables converging at some point or at some time with oil and gas sector. You can have floating facilities, wind and hydrogen. So the requirements for new skills, standards, competence, implications, and transferability of current skills into this transformed world. So I don't know. I'll start with you, Lawrence. I guess, you know, what do you think the energy transition is going to impact in terms of the standards, the regulations we work under for lifting and rigging operations, competency implications, or transferability of current skill?
I think as a service company, we love that. I mean, it opens up more markets, it opens up more opportunities, and it opens up sort of a diverse workforce that you have to develop. I think with regards to the guidelines of assessing and standards and regulations we were talking about, I don't think we've got much more. I've got much more to add to what I said earlier. But with regards to the energy transition, we're already in it. I mean, we're working heavily in the renewables business. We're working in the decommissioning business. We're supporting operations and duty holders and clients in all sectors of the energy transition. So I think we're comfortable and excited about that. We're providing more innovations every year. We're coming out with four or five new innovations around our motion compensated systems. And I think it's just a challenge, absolutely, like Brexit is before. Although I wanted to add the point is I think I'm the only European citizen on this panel, so I feel for you guys. Good luck. But I think the energy transition can only be an opportunity for everyone rather than a hindrance. I think we just need to rise to the challenge.
Okay, thanks for that. So Hugh, as a supplier of safe lift equipment or under the heading of safe lift, what's your view in terms of the implications that you know, the convergence of these two sectors almost coming together?
Yeah.
Do you think that's going to have an impact on the product, on the capability of the individuals, things like that?
Yeah. And in fact, just to follow on from what Lorenz was saying, that it's an opportunity for sure, but it also drives us towards innovation because the standard product range that we have has to be adapted, modified to suit the applications in some of the new energy sectors. And indeed, completely new products need to be developed from scratch. So, you know, that's a challenge, it's an opportunity, and it certainly drives innovation, which is great. As far as the opportunity is concerned, I just read yesterday that to meet our own domestic targets in terms of net zero and low carbon, we have to install a wind turbine per day for the next 10 years. So that gives us some idea of the scale of the opportunity. It's Mm-hmm. In saying that, as well as the opportunity, we can be sure that many of the skill sets that we've developed in the oil and gas section over many years, and a lot of the products that we've developed, are certainly transferable into these new industries. We just need to understand how they fit in there and how the supply chain works, which does take a little bit of time to get a hold of. I'd also have to say that it will present us with a new customer base. Although some of the traditional operators are transitioning themselves into these new energies, we've got a lot of new players that we've got very little knowledge of or very little history of doing business with. So that's a little bit of a challenge to establish ourselves on their vendors' lists and create an awareness amongst their organizations of our possibilities. I think we'd also have to recognize that over the piece, we're going to require a smaller workforce to support these industries. We're not going to see large production platforms with 100 plus POBs. That's unlikely. We're not going to need drilling rigs to the same extent, drilling rigs which we would provide product to. So we have to find new opportunities. The most obvious of those, I guess, would be the likes of the big installation vessels, which are coming on stream, most of those being managed overseas. So again, we've got the challenge as a manufacturer, as a supply company, to get in contact with those organizations and create an awareness of what we can do to support them.
Okay, thanks for that, Hugh. So I guess, Brian, I'll go to you next. So as an operator perspective, so we've got an increased amount, and I don't know what CNO or C are doing in terms of their energy transition plans at the moment, but you've got an increased number of floating things offshore now, either producing power or the producing power to produce hydrogen, and they're only going to increase. So I guess as a technical authority lifting, does that concern you in terms of, you know, CNO or C or other operators will be involved in these floating structures significantly smaller than FPSOs, so the stability of these things is quite less, I guess. Does that give you any major concerns in terms of adequacy of what we do now?
I can, in that environment? Within the next few months, we'll be having the Pioneering Spirit come within 30 mm-hmm. meters of one of our installations. For those of you who don't know the Pioneering Spirit, that's a huge double hull thing that can lift the whole platform mm-hmm. off in one go. So you know, in those terms, you know, lifting activities coming from, you know, third parties is a huge risk to us. So if we can talk just very briefly about carbon transition and how it's affecting Scenic specifically. So Scenic's a Chinese owned company, okay, Chinese national offshore oil company, right? And I've given CPL, the Scenic Petroleum Unit Limited, quite aggressive targets in terms of energy transition and carbon neutral, right? So, without talking about it too much, some of those things are to do with vessels and the type of vessels we hire, right, and how green those vessels are. So they're kind of pushing us about, don't go for the dirty old man, go for the nice clean new ones, right? But in terms of the other parts of the offshore, there's a transition, or the company is now in transition away from burning, you know, fuel gas and diesel oil when that's not available, to putting in floating wind farms. And what we're going to do is we've got certain areas which have previously had wellheads, right? So these are sites which still have some seabed clutter, and we're going to put wind farms in those areas. And that thing's all in planning right now. Okay, so that does, you know, there'll be an involvement of ourselves in terms of the ongoing maintenance of those things. And that brings in that kind of ties in with the first point, okay, because the lifting activities which will be performed on these floating wind farms, and even if they're fixed wind farms, but more likely floating, right, are going to be very, very specific, okay. So I would suggest it would be much more important that we train those people to do the types of lifts they will be expected to perform better than we would to give them a more generic qualification of an APITO standard. Okay, and that's where we may then start to see that divergence away from purely APITO, unless APITO then recognise this deficient area and choose to kind of jump on the bandwagon, if you like. When those demands really start coming to light, we'll start to see these changes, if you like, in some of these standards.
Okay, that's good. So it brings me on to in the same area into the energy transition. So I guess Ben, I'll come to you. So transferability of skills, and this, like I said earlier, this convergence of two sectors almost, where you know you've got the oil and gas industry that has really developed its standards over the years. A lot of them are unique to the North Sea in terms of what we've got, and then you've got the floating wind things coming in that are going to be power generating. I think is there from an engineering service point of view and lifting and rigging, so did you have any particular take on how we're going to get these two together and how we're going to get them to jive?
Not particularly. We cover a lot of industries as a trade association, and what we find is that what we learn in one industry we can use to educate and improve another. We do see a lot of challenges with adapting perhaps general purpose equipment and people for that matter for inspecting and using adapting to special and specific applications and environments. But generally, through the knowledge we gain elsewhere, we're able to help and find solutions to problems that are specific in specific industries. In terms of that particular problem, I've not really got much of a to offer on that, I'm afraid.
Okay.
Hugh was saying as well, I'm sorry, he backed me up with regards to the opportunity to introduce innovations. I think by introducing innovations, you're sort of narrowing that segue between what is the traditional operating environment to what the new transition is. For example, vessel-based crane operations are essentially the same on a platform as they are on a floating structure, because of in our case the motion compensation that we offer. So I think and further innovations will create that narrowing of the segue between the transitions. I think innovations has a big part to play in helping minimize the challenge, I guess, and minimize the headache that's going to cause this.
Without a doubt, the acceleration of technology and innovation coming into the industry is going to help. So that brings me nicely on to the third area that we wanted to discuss, which is how to maintain competency levels in the sector. So I'll start this off with a question that's come in on the chatter, and it's I hope it doesn't mind, from Mark Cowison. Hope you don't mind me naming you there, Mark. Does the group agree that without a standardized training and competence approach, the workforce who can regularly move between organizations are forever having to train and prove competencies against different standards, adding unnecessary cost to companies? So I want to turn that on first. Hugh, I'll go to you first.
Yeah,
Hugh.
I mean, I think that observation has to be valid on the whole. You could argue that for some specific disciplines or specific sectors, unique training syllabus is required. But certainly we've seen over the piece that the demand from various parties for certification to different standards, to different levels, not just for personnel, in fact, but for product as well, can cause difficulties, can cause issues. Does it really make the product any safer? Does it make the operation any safer? I think those are the things you've got to bear in mind.
Okay. And an operator perspective, Brian?
Yeah, this is a difficult one, this one, right? Your Bapito came about, or UMPAR came about, to create that standardization to allow that fluidity, that movement of personnel, so that if you had somebody coming from another company, you could be reasonably assured that they had a certain competency level. Okay. So, and we do that, right? And that is generally done. But we generally do that through, because we make use of, if you like, companies who provide the personnel, right? So without naming names, but there are a number of companies out there who have a group of people who provide not only people to us, but to other operators as well in other areas of industry. And we rely on that. If it then turned that we were then employing people directly, right, then I think we would have a different case then, because what we'd have to do is assure ourselves that that third party assurance, training assurance, was fit for purpose. Okay. And they weren't simply signing off on certificates. And because we've mentioned that there's a logbook, you know, they've got to do a certain amount of lifts. Well, you can, some ridiculous situation where a guy walks up the gangway, I need 20 lifts here. Anybody fill this logbook out for us? There you go. And away he goes and gets a stage three, right? And there's nothing that actually prevents that from happening. The only thing that prevents that from happening is the competence of the individual and the people around him, but also his employer, right? And so myself personally, I'd be quite nervous about simply accepting another, if you like, another operator's personnel without there being some level of due diligence on that.
Okay, so it's an old acorn, but it's kind of a discipline specific passport that allows people to move freely from one employer to the next, which brings us on to the next. But this again comes back to the point I raised a couple of times. It was a convergence of two sectors, because we've got the renewable sector converging with the oil and gas sector, and although they operate under the same legal system, the standards differ. And at some point, if we're going to make it as efficient and cost effective as possible, and make it as risk free as possible, that convergence of standards surely has got to happen at some point. But that brings you on to the next point, which is transferability of skills around the industry as a whole. Now, this is something that I, in a previous life, got heavily involved in, and it is restrictive. And then add into that, so I've got only the use of ex-military personnel and people from other industries coming in, you know, transferring across the oil and gas industry into other industries and back again. So I'll go to Hugh. I'll go to you first. If we're going to be truly as cost effective as possible and as risk aware as possible, surely if people can, you know, because rigging and lifting, I'm a pretty simple person. So to me, I'm an instrument engineer in my background. Instrument engineering is instrument engineering is instrument engineering. And okay, there might be nuances, but surely lifting and rigging is lifting and rigging. So where do you think where we are and where we should be heading in terms of transferability of skills across industries?
Well, obviously, in general, we could say that lifting and rigging operations are typically a mechanical discipline in one shape or form. And I can imagine that there's many personnel from the armed forces who've had exposure to fairly complex lifting and rigging operations as part of their duties. So if we're talking about a narrow stream of personnel transferring out of that environment to the commercial environment, to the marketplace, then I think in theory and on paper, many of them would have a lot to bring to the table in terms of their experience and competency. It's just then integrating them, I guess, into the commercial marketplace. And I do know from personal experience through acquaintances and different people that in many cases that can be quite a struggle, can be quite a challenge, because it's a very different environment for them if compared to what they've been used to up till that point. But yeah, I think definitely some positive possibilities in terms of that workforce.
Okay, good. So, so Brian, I'll go back to you again from an. Oh, sorry, Bed. Were you putting your hand up there? No.
You can go to Brian. It's fine. I just had a point to make on that as well.
Right, Brian. So again, okay, Brian. So from an operative perspective, because I know, and you mentioned it there earlier that you know you'd be very wary of bringing in somebody from another operator's. You know, so what would need to happen in order to break down those barriers in terms of a guy turns up with a passport or a ticket or a some sort of credential that you look at and say, right, fine.
Okay, so there are three areas of concern, right? One is about the standard to which that person's been trained to. So what's his experience level? Yeah, so his experience and his training gives us his competency. The other one is about how recent was that? Because if this guy could be a stage for, you know, Banks and Slinger or Rigger, but he hasn't done a lift for 2 years, right? And the other one as well is about familiarization with your company's lifting process, okay? Because they're not, however much you'd like to believe, they are all slightly different, okay? So is it possible to transition somebody in from the Army? 100%, it's completely, you're able to do that. But you're only able to do that if you have a robust transition process. So it's for the, you know, this isn't an individual like myself, you know, saying this is what industry must do. Each company must recognize the level of need in their company to transition the people dependent on the complexity of the lifting operation. If they're doing relatively simple lifting operations, say if they're going to go out and be doing, you know, single chain block lifting rigging activities, then you can see that there's not going to be too much for those guys really to be overly concerned with. But if you're doing, you know, multiple chain hoist, you know, slinging operations, then that's much more difficult. Okay, so you know, they're the threat areas.
Okay, no, that's good. So we've got another question just come in from Les Smith. So what's the group's thoughts on this? With the renewables sector coming more to the fore, he can't see, or I can't see why they are not accepting certification personnel, i.e. a PTO, GWO, are insisting that they have to complete GWO training courses. So again, it seems to be sector nuances that are actually being put into play here. And I guess, you know, lessons learned and all the journey that we've all been through from 2014 onwards, you know, what the maximizing economic return out of the UKCS, you know, we waste a lot of money. So I guess the question to you guys is, so how, what would we do, what would we need to do to really force the issue and get real standardization into the energy sector as opposed to wind, renewables, whatever, and you know, allow guys to move from nuclear power into offshore survivals and things like that aside. We're talking about rigging and lifting skills and competence, because we do know that there is a skill shortage in this sector. So what would we need to do, in your opinions, to start the process of rectifying that? Because it does seem to be an enduring issue in our sector. I'll open it up. I'll let any one of you answer that.
Yeah, I don't think there's a quick solution to this. I mean, you know, as an employing company, you know, we're for lifting activities, we're kind of guided by, you know, Reg 8 of Lola and Reg 9, I think it is a PUA. You know, Reg 8 talks about having adequate supervision, right? And Reg 9 talks about people being adequately trained for the duties that they're expected to perform and the equipment that they're expected to use. And that may well be the approach of GWO, is that they're not saying that this PTO trained guy isn't competent to do rigging activities. What they're saying is that for their specific equipment they're using to perform those lifting activities, or that the load that they're lifting, right, or the level of supervision they'll be receiving in doing those lifting activities, right, they need to train them specific to that, And we kind of, and I do apologize, I'll just finish off. But we had this similar situation with the light load lifting, if you like, where when I joined the company, they were trained to a PTO stage one. You know, so they were on a, they were unassessed personnel, very, very rarely doing a lifting activity. You know, the APITO, the stage one training that provided them types of lifts that they weren't really getting involved in. So we went down our own route and we created our own light load lifting course, which we expect these technicians to do.
Okay. No, thanks, Brett. Ben, you wanted to...
Yeah, we see that there is a significant shortfall of skills across all sectors with an aging workforce and few engineers coming up through the ranks. There are a couple of ways that LEAD is pushing to fill these gaps and remedy the situation for those in the inspection, maintenance and for examination of lifting equipment. The first is due to the current pandemic and complete closure of certain industries, such as the entertainment industry, for example. There are many skilled inspectors with transferable skills that could easily fill gaps in other industries, particularly those that may be doing a bit better. And it's just a case of bridging the gaps and putting people in trade, in touch with each other and adding additional training in there. The second is our military transition scheme that LEAD has. This scheme is designed to support the transition into civilian lifting equipment industry for veterans and reservists within 2 years of leaving the military service. LEAD recognised that ex-military personnel with transferable skills can potentially provide an important additional resource to our industry. And therefore, we're offering a package of benefits to military veteran and reservists that can support this initiative. And finally, we're also looking towards schools. We have our Think Lifting initiative, which is aimed at introducing the lifting equipment industry to school children and getting them to think about the interesting and varied lucrative careers or opportunities that are available to them. We've been circulating videos on the subject through our media channels, which are really worth a view and can be found in our learning zone. But we're also delivering education packages that include lifting equipment experiments for kids to give them a hands-on enjoyable experience and get them thinking about lifting in order to come up through the ranks and fill these skill shortages that we have.
Okay, John, thanks for that, Ben. So you mentioned there, Brian, at the beginning of yours, that it's not going to be fixed tomorrow. I agree. But we have been trying to fix this for at least two decades in this industry, and we don't seem to be able to do it. So I think, like I said, I think you know, now that we've got these two sectors getting ever closer, I think there is an opportunity, surely, that we should make one last effort to try and do that and standardize as far as practically possible acceptance across the industry as opposed to acceptance by employer. Yeah. Because it is an enduring issue.
Sorry, I'm going to harp on about innovation again. And I think in the chat that Mark Cowerson has brought up an innovative way to potentially address this. It's all about bridging that gap between the procedures and operating parameters in the old style oil and gas sector and potentially in the renewables. And one area would be as what he's suggesting, you know, some kind of video diaries or some technology that records that you can't mess with, like Brian was saying, that you can't just say he did 20 lifts. It's out there. It's all out there. It's just a matter of someone the idea and saying this little niche problem, I think we've got a really good solution. And that would save so much headache, like we've been discussing for the last 10 minutes.
Give an idea true. why people who haven't met technical authorities before, right, why a lot of people don't like technical authorities in responding to these questions. Okay, so I do apologize in doing this, right? So it, with regards to your comment initially, Neil, you know, there's a nature of the beast thing within all this, okay? You know, what we can't do is to make something which, you know, adapts to the desire of the market, which is to cut costs, move, you know, allow easy transition, and then immediately place those guys at risk, right? We just can't do that, okay? So if it is always the case that a certain level of transition training, which without knowing what the GWO training is necessary, then I'd be supportive of that. Okay, if it's going to take 5 extra days to give somebody some familiarization training, some additional supervision and things like this, then that's what we do. if that means that we're going to reduce the level of risk to the individual. Yeah. And to come to Lorenz and to Mark's comment with regards to glasses, it's possible, right? But it would take, we have to recognize that there are complexities in that in terms of they'd have to be all the safety aspects of the job. Because what we don't want to do is to distract the person. You imagine the guy's involved in a complex lifting operation, and he's wearing a pair of glasses, and he's thinking, well, hang on a minute, am I doing this? Am I doing that? The glasses are on. So we'd have to do the human factors study to determine that maybe the glasses should be on a third party, right? Who's an independent observer, observing several people performing the lifting activity so they all can get signed off on the same location. So those things are potentially doable.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're right. I think, but just before I pick up on the technology bit, is you said that it's reducing costs. Brian, I don't think it's about reducing costs. I think it's about taking out the wasted cost. It's about because as long as we exist with multiple standards, we will be wasting money. Because where operators are spending money unnecessarily, whereas if we just had the one and everybody went through the same process and was establishing and measured against the same standards, that would take a lot of waste out of the system, and you would end up with a more focused product at the end, which is a competent rigger. That's just my view, it's not about cost reduction.
I do apologize. But what you've got to be careful of, and we've seen it at PETA and we've seen it at IMCA as well, is that when there's an approach to standardize the industry, what happens is you tend to creep up towards the highest denominator, right? I.e., you've got a group of people, a group of companies all sat around the table trying to agree a standard. The guy's saying, I want everybody in gold lamé suits, wearing a pink tutu and all that. The guy with the highest standard people tend to draw towards their argument. Okay. And that's why we get APITO. I sat in the APITO standards review, one of the meetings with regards to that. And we had the Middle Eastern, and some other nations, in the same meeting saying, APITO is too complex. We can't get our guys through the standard. And what we ended up with, because of, some individuals in the room, is an APITO standard, which actually ended up being more complex, right? Because they saw that their need to have enhanced assurance activities and things of this, right? And that's where you just got to be careful. So I think where we could end up with potentially is one or two standards, if you like, but they've got to be tailored to the industry, right? And then a transition program to each company, okay? Which is, I think, not far from where we are. I mean, people accept APITO, but they just like to make sure that APITO-trained person is able to do the lift activities in the way that they want them to.
No, I agree. I mean, because at the end of the day, this is about reducing the risk, so... that's what you do. So that moves us onto the next fourth point, which is how technology will change sector and we'll see the advent of autonomous cranes, well, or lifting. So just picking up on a point that you made earlier there, though, Brian, is we had the company I work for, I have a software partner who are heavily involved in an awful lot of industries, from automotive to space to everything else. And part of the offering that we make is, and it's becoming in the technology space, digital twins in the oil and gas sector, which incidentally is something that other sectors have had for 15 years. And the ability to be able to simulate, so getting onto the risk assessment piece. So if you have a digital twin of your asset and you want to simulate a heavy lift or a complex lift or whatever, these things are all dimensional. And as everything else, the cost of these things is significantly reduced. The cost benefit of them is significantly increased. And I've even seen simulations where the building of the Shard in London, where they've actually done every single lift simulated with people, barriers, the whole works, wind factors, everything being built into this model, so they know exactly where everybody should be and everything else. And then moving on to the company in technology, which is remote operations from being able is doing. And again, assessing a guy's competence through remote technologies is all capable. It's all there. It's not new. It's all available. But moving on to the fourth point of how technology will change the sector. So one of the points that we wanted to get through is self-monitoring lifting equipment that alerts when maintenance is required or when it needs recertified. So, Hugh, I'll go to you first on this one. How do you think technology is going to advance lifting and rigging in the sector?
So it's a tricky one for me to answer in some respects, because speaking with my company's hat on, one of our key design philosophies is actually to make the product as simple as possible, as dumb as possible, if you like, so that the use of the products is more intuitive. It's easier for the personnel to understand and effect. We then introduce technology that allows a degree of automation or self-learning that potentially creates some issues in terms of usage. It certainly changes the price point dramatically. So, it would have to be driven by the need on the customer's part to a large extent for higher degrees of safety and efficiency to offset that higher cost. So that's one thing to bear in mind. But from a personal point of view, perhaps a couple of things that I'm aware of that are very interesting is the Loadmaster robotic device that's been developed by a company in Norway to allow for unmanned lifting cargo decks on offshore platforms and offshore vessels. The idea there is to avoid personnel being in a dangerous environment as cargo is being hooked up for offload or for reloading. I'm also aware that in Western Australia, there's a very high level of automation in terms of the handling and movement of mineral resources in what I can only imagine previously was a very high-risk, dangerous environment for people to be exposed to. And then as recently as yesterday, there was the article about the use of drones for delivering medical supplies, which previously would have had to be delivered by, let's say, road, with all the risks that involves, in delays and whatever. So, yeah, it's a very interesting topic and one that we have to keep a tab on and develop certain products to allow a degree of automation. One of the products that we have can be pre-programmed to follow a specific route around, say, a hospital building or a manufacturing hall, delivering materials, picking up materials without any intervention other than the programming of the product beforehand.
Okay, no, thanks. Ben, do you have anything to input on this in terms of technology and the use of lifting operations?
Autonomous cranes are nothing new, really, and the technology is there to potentially make any crane type autonomous. However, we generally see such cranes being beneficially used in large-scale manufacturing industries, as Hughes alluded to there. They have the advantages in that the systems can compute process paths to find optimal routes that can be much more efficient than manual equipment or manual operation. However, there is the disadvantage that computer technology is also subject to cyber attacks and viruses that can potentially cause dangerous situations. But autonomy in terms of motion operation is only one consideration, and we believe that there is another side to autonomy that has many advantages. Many cranes are now designed on the limit state principle, which means that they have a finite life based on the number and magnitude of lift cycles, for example. So through limit state design, we can predict quite accurately the life of a crane or critical components. And through condition monitoring systems, we can check with some accuracy when a crane will require inspection or overhaul or repair. Some condition monitoring equipment can inspect the crane components during each lift cycle. And it gives us a much bigger picture of the rate of deterioration compared to traditional techniques. Moreover, when a crane has reached its design life, for example, some crane systems are even that advanced where they can shut themselves down and isolate until the problem's actually been addressed. But in many situations, manufacturers are able to supply repair kits and sub-assemblies that can simply be changed out when required, which sort of negates the need to completely strip down at each thorough examination a hoist unit, for example, or a complex assembly, which incidentally is something that really happens due to practicalities of doing that. And therefore, condition monitoring and design life tend to eliminate an uncertainty and improve the safety and longevity of certain cranes as well.
Good. Lawrence,
yeah.
You...
I think our business, we rely as a service company, and I'm sure everyone appreciates this, we rely heavily on the service that we provide using our equipment. We have a fairly high standard delivery or performance, and therefore our systems are fairly complex. Not like the ones that maybe Hugh was talking about. So we have sort of we have a hexapod that delivers motion compensation, which is inherently a fairly complex bit of kit. And the way that we deal with remote interrogation and information regarding maintenance and also safety is number one through redundancy, and number two through remote interrogation in terms of getting into the software from the office through our operations control center. So we have 24-hour access of the individual equipment to see which complex features are failing, and we can be proactive in avoiding any failure. And our service-led approach through the operators that we deliver with the equipment, the crane operators in this case, they then attack that and make sure that there's no safety infringement, and also some preventative maintenance happens. Mm-hmm. And I think as things, again, I'm going on about innovation. I think as things progress, you know, this is going to become more and more remote. And we're looking into autonomous gangways already, autonomous delivery of gangways. Mm-hmm. And cranes are only just another sub-product of ours.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I guess... a point raised here by Goran Gramatikov, excuse me if I've pronounced your surname wrong, but he's saying most of the technologies that apply to typical or general operations, where most of the operations in energy sector are non-routine. The secondary challenge would be downtime. So I guess reliability of the equipment is significant. Cyber security is certainly something I know BV are heavily involved in terms of the marine side of the world, as is digital simulation, something else that they're heavily involved in. And another comment here from Keith Jennings, remote viewing of anything offshore via things like LibreStream, and I know, again, BB, we use that quite a lot, is now a common practice now and a great tool. This has been accelerated with restrictions brought on by COVID. Yes, absolutely. I know we saw a big take-up in remote inspection requirements during 2020 as a result of that. So I think the technology to properly observe a lifting operation, or to collaborate on a lift plan or a risk analysis, or witness an individual doing stuff, is the technologies are less. So in that context, and the price of this technology now is buttons in comparison when it was even 5-10 years ago. But one of the other points, because we are heading towards our time stop, but one of the other things I want to put to the panel, and I guess it probably points towards you, Brian. So as technology advances and we get more innovation into there, and you know, autonomous lifting devices are there, cranes, motion compensators, skill set requirement and impact on jobs. So clearly the skill set requirement to be involved in remote lifting operations or autonomous lifting operations is going to change, and that is going to impact jobs. Now, given the skill shortage that we have, the issues that we have in maintaining competence even now with chain blocks and pulleys, excuse me, I've been a bit simplistic, surely as technology advances, that is going to significantly change.
Yeah, I think one of the people on the chat and other comments here have recognized that there is a difference between, if you like, you know, relatively standardized lifting operations, you know, and what occurs, for example, in the workplace on an offshore installation. And to try and bring a level of automation, say, between the decks, is going to be really quite difficult. Okay. You know, in terms of, because there are two things, and I'll try and be brief because you said, I recognize time's getting short, but in terms of, an automated lifting activity, okay, from my side as a technical authority, I'm interested more, not when it's going right and everything's tickety-boo, it's about when that thing goes wrong, okay? And, you know, one thing that humans are really good at is making a decision, right, when things are going wrong. What they're able to do is to recognize that the most favorable option, even when that accepts a level of risk. So you could imagine, you could quite easily design a system that recognizes a fault, shuts itself down. But it's just done that while we've got a load, which is a foot off the deck, right, in a heavy seas, so that the load now keeps slamming into the deck. And what could have happened is that the guy could have, if it's a crane operator, could have raised the load and got it well clear of the deck. Then it may be that things can be done with regards to that. But that's one thing that I'd bring up. The other one as well is about, you talked there about skill sets and things like that. And it's a really good point, and it's a really good justification to bring in additional automation. And that's why it's seen a hell of a lot onshore in the onshore industry. Just as a caveat to that, you know, we have to be really careful about something called automation dependency, right? And that's where we become overly dependent on these things always working correctly. So when they do choose to go wrong, right, the people we have who we believe will act correctly, right, to save the situation, just don't have the right knowledge, right, or even the confidence, which is, when we look at DP systems and ships and how ships are operated, one of the biggest problems with people going to a manual reversion mode is that they're not confident to do that. So rather than fix things, rather than go manual and move the boat away, they'll try and fix a DP, right? And that's when we have these really big incidents that you've probably heard of. I'll leave it at that as well, just at that point, I think.
Okay, now thanks for that, Brian. I'll open it up to the rest of the panel then in terms of skills, implications, and levels of technology introduction into lifting operations.
Yeah, in general terms, I've been following a lot of the work that Paul Delu has done at RGU around this topic, and his suggestion is that quite probably right now we're training people for the wrong vocations that won't be as mainstream, won't be as current in a very short space of time. And that then leads us to what Brian was alluding to, the need to train people in these new disciplines, the ability to oversee an autonomous operation, let's say, and to be able to make the judgment when that autonomous lifting operation or rigging operation is not going according to plan and make that intervention. Yeah.
Okay. Lawrence, Ben, Jovi?
No, not much, but I'm a firm believer in keeping people in the operation. I think they are the ones that make the decisions, as Brian said. They're the ones that pull up rather than just wait to see what happens. And you can't take that cost away. They're priceless. Not always possible, obviously, but
now I guess if you look at other industries, which I have done quite a bit in terms of digital twinning and things, like I say, other industries seem to have advanced significantly faster in these areas than the oil and gas sector. And I think one of the things that, so to me, one of the problems that we have at the moment is, having been in this industry for a long, long time, the oil, apart from downhole technology, give or take one or two other things, it's evolved at a glacial pace in terms of change. It's done stuff. It's moved on. It's obsessive. Whereas now the pace of change in the innovative technological world that we live in now is lightning fast in comparison to what we're used to. And I think part of the issue is the oil and gas industry struggling with the pace of change.
Sorry for interrupting you, but in the good days when prices are high, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. That's the general approach the oil and gas industry has had. And now the prices aren't good. We have to become innovative, and we're not very good at it, I think. And because we are glacially, glacially slow.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess it'll be interesting, but I guess the factor now is this repositioning by oil companies for all the right reasons to become energy companies and investing in renewable energies, and all of that technology now has been, I don't know, forced together almost in that they have to change. So it'll be interesting to see how it goes. So I think I'll just take the point now to thank all four of you for your time and input today. It's been, well, I found it very interesting anyway, and there's never enough time to discuss subjects like this. I've no doubt we could sit here for a whole week and discuss it. And I don't think we have any more questions. There's a comment from Patrick McCory about ex-military training programs have been run with AMEC and Teesside Rigging and Lifting Companies organization. Gorans, we got. So I think we've covered all of the points that have been raised. So unless there's any last minute questions. So I'll take the opportunity to say, like I said, thanks very much. Thanks to the sponsors. Thanks to OGV for making this happen. If there's no other questions coming in, which I don't think there is, I think we will wrap up the panel session. Please visit network. All right, okay. So now the networking session begins, people. So anybody who wants to join the networking session, if you go to the left-hand column on your screen, you'll see networking. And if you just press that, then you'll be able to join the networking. So other than that, thank you very much. And keep putting your questions in, because I'm pretty sure that Dan will redistribute them accordingly.
Thank you, Neil.
So thanks a lot. Cheers, guys.